Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren. We are recording from the west coast of Sweden, and this is our very own internet talk radio program. We feature new program every Thursday and Sunday, available on our website redicecreations.com. We are working on spreading important information and spark curiosity about our world and our reality. And before we begin today, I'd also just want to mention that we recently opened up our little shop. We have some t-shirts up there with a few different designs, a few with our Red Ice Creations logo. There are some stickers, mugs and bags available there also. So beyond our radio show subscriber section, if you buy something from the shop, that's a great way to support us and help us keep going here. Alrighty, today we have Matthew Deleuze back with us on the program. We had Matthew first back on in October, and he's been keeping busy writing some very interesting articles on his blog that we are going to dive deeper into today. I also want to mention that Matthew is the author of The Stars Are Falling, and his new and upcoming book is called Is It Me for a Moment? Breaking the Serpent's Spell. And you can find much more info about this on his blog. And the address to that is matthew-deleuze.blogspot.com, and we're going to spell that out for you later on too, so you get that right. You can also find his books on davidikebooks.co.uk. So with that, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Matthew Deleuze. Thank you for coming on again, Matthew.
Oh, that's absolutely no problem. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be invited back on and have a little chat with you.
Yeah, indeed. You know, we had you first back in October, and as I said, you've been keeping busy. You got a new upcoming book, and you have been writing some excellent articles on your blog, and I thought that it would be a very good place to kind of begin there today. I recently posted your latest article called The Answer, My Friend, is Blowing in the Wind, that of course goes into the theme of the festival and the festivals of light that we briefly touched upon last time you were on. You know, it's about spiritual energy, intent, and the reason behind, you know, very big events such as the Glastonbury Festival, and you go into that in some detail in your latest article, but maybe that's not the right place to begin, because I know before that you wrote an article series called Festivals of Light, where you, among other things, talk about the Blackpool illuminations and much, much more. Maybe we could begin on that end. Is that an appropriate place to begin, Matthew?
Well, yes, to explain to your listeners how I've actually gone into this research, I need to explain to them that I'm just not just thinking these things up. I've actually been on a journey since 1999, and to cut a long story short, as I mentioned last time I was on, I suffered what I term as a traumatic awakening in the late 90s. I have not been the same person since. I seem to be being pushed and directed, and sometimes pushed to places I don't really want to go, but I feel directed to do so. And to start off, to tell your listeners about how I'm getting to these conclusions about music and festivals, is I have to go back to 2004, August 2004, in which I felt directed to go and have a weekend away. It's a place called Morecambe in Lancashire, mm-hmm. England. It was a bank holiday weekend, a full moon weekend, actually. Mm. And Morecambe is a very downtrodden, scruffy, dirty sort of place. It's not a very popular place. I wouldn't say it was very popular at all. But I got this strong urge to go to Morecambe for some reason. And off I set off Morecambe with my dear little wife, and we set off for the weekend. And I was very surprised when I arrived in Morecambe, because you could just usually just walk in. Well, if you go to Morecambe, you can just usually go and book in an hotel or a guest house or whatever. Mm. You just need to turn up. They never booked up. They never ever full. But on this occasion, I didn't know anything about it when I was going. I just decided I was going for a little weekend away. But when I arrived there, I found the town absolutely full. It was absolutely jam full of people. Mm. And I managed to find a very, very poor, downtrodden guest house to stop in. Very luckily, by coincidence as well, I knocked on about 10, 15 different hotel doors trying to get a room, and eventually I got one. He was way out of the centre itself.
Mm-hmm.
Again, to cut a long story short, I decided to have a walk out on the evening to go for a drink of beer in a bar, and I heard that there was a festival. It was called the Festival of Light and Water.
Mm-hmm.
Festival of Light and Water.
Yeah.
And the guest house landlady was telling me about this festival, and I'd never heard of it before. I'd lived in Lancashire for all my life. I'm 48 years old now, so
mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard of it. So anyway, we're walking on the promenade, and I felt a strong urge to go and have a look at the festival. I found out that there was some Susie Quattro. I don't know if you've heard of her in Sweden. Susie Quattro, a singer from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
You might be too young yourself. She was a favourite of mine, was Susie Quattro.
Mm-hmm.
So I would obviously wanted to go and see Susie Quattro play on stage.
Sure.
It was all free. It was an open air festival. And as I was watching Susie on the stage and taking note of the people, I started to get strange feelings that there was something more to the festival than met the eye. It felt very, very strange.
Mm-hmm.
And I was transfixed on the people, I'm more transfixed on the people actually watching the concert than I was on watching the artists.
Yeah.
And I basically, I was people watching. And I was just watching people's behaviour at these things, and they were all enjoying the cellar, drinking, and basically it was an happy atmosphere.
Mm.
And then the groups changed, and Susie went off, and a tribute band came on for Queen, and they started singing the Queen hits. Everybody knows the Queen hits around the world. Sure. We are the champions, and
sure.
70s of Rye, all this caper.
Yeah.
And I noticed a change in the atmosphere with the rock music from Susie's pop music. You know, the atmosphere changed, and they seen the energy change.
Mm.
And anyway, I left the festival alone, and I went for a drink in a bar, and then. I returned. It was a two-night festival.
Mm-hmm.
And then I returned the night after, and on my way down, I started noticing that there was a fairground near where the festival was taking place, where the stage was.
Yeah.
And I just... The lights of the fairground attracted me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to notice... I'd noticed it the night before, but I just... brushed it off as me being, you know, daft or mad or whatever. I just brushed it off, and I thought, well,
okay.
Anyway, the second night I went, I started looking at the fairground attractions again, and I noticed that the Ferris wheel, the previous night, it was flashing different sort of images on it.
Mm.
They altered the light bulbs, and they were showing... different shapes in this antenna.
Hmm.
And the second night I went, the actual lights on the Ferris wheel had changed to another a different shape altogether.
Hmm.
Basically, there was on the first time they were showing a pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The axis of the Ferris wheel was being lit up, and it light showed a pyramid.
Yeah.
And on the second night, there was like an eye.
Hmm.
Obviously, I can see it now in 2007. In 2004, I wasn't as experienced as I am now.
Sure.
But it was having an effect on me even then.
Hmm.
It was my initiation into understanding these things.
Yeah.
So I'm taking all this these lights and different shapes on the Ferris wheel, and I'm listening to the music at the same time, and I'm watching the crowd, and I'm basically, I felt like I was being educated, if that makes sense.
Hmm.
It felt like some sort of force had got me to to walk on Morecambe Promenade in August 2004 and actually witness what was going on, because I'd never dreamed of doing anything like that before. So, and then I started having I started taking a real interest in it and started really examining what were going on around me. And I put everything together. I put the music, the lyrics, I listened to the lyrics of the songs. I put the crowd, they were excited or enjoying themselves, drinking and happy and laughing and waving at the artist. And I put the symbolism, the lit Ferris wheel, and other symbolism that were around me at the time. And when you start looking into symbolism that's around you, it starts to open up and you can see more and more and more of it.
Yeah.
And basically, that was it. I went out again after I went for a drink, and then the weekend were over, I went home. And the next few days while I was at home, it seemed to get, it went out of my mind, but it kept coming back and sort of pushing me in the mind to think and learn what was going on. So then I decided to write it down, what I was feeling, and I did a little article called Beside the Seaside. Just to explain what I actually felt on that August, and to record it for myself, basically.
Sure.
And then I started thinking, is it possible that certain pop groups, especially the famous ones, obviously I'll mention Queen, because it's easy to do, people like Elton John and Madonna and Prince, they've all got very symbolic names.
Yeah.
And then if you look into their songs, if you've got many, many hours to do it, you can find that there's very ambiguous statements in the lyrics. You know, and they always seem to match up with ancient gods or ancient mythology or something to do with demons, the devils, or all this sort of thing. So, when you really think about it, if you're in a crowd and you've got Freddie Mercury on the stage, or somebody pretending to be Freddie Mercury, as they do these days, and you're singing and dancing along with him whenever he's singing, I came to the conclusion that you're actually celebrating what he's saying. You're actually going along with it.
Yeah.
If Freddie Mercury's on the stage singing I am the champion, or we are the champions, then, and you're going yeah, singing around, waving at him and all this, obviously you're agreeing with it. Even though it's only on a 5 cent level, it's only enjoying yourself and partying.
Sure. You're playing along with it.
You're just going along with it. You're tempted to just basically agree with what they say, or you show it through emotion. You're not actually saying, yes, Freddie, I agree with her, but your actions and your emotion are actually loving what he's saying.
Yeah.
If that makes sense to you.
Indeed.
And your listeners, of course, you're actually emotionally agreeing with what they're doing and what they're singing.
Yeah.
You know, you're not actually on a 5 cent level doing it, but inside yourself, your spiritual self, you're actually condoning whatever's being said. And I took it further from there. And I thought, well, how do these festivals start to appear? When did they start?
Yeah.
You know, who organises them? Because they were free. It was free. This festival was free.
Yeah.
And when you start thinking, especially in England, I can only speak for England, obviously, but in England, nothing's free. Everything costs money.
Yeah.
And when you get told that something's free, I always look for the catch. You know, there's always sort of catch in this country anyway.
Sure.
If there's something for free, there must be a catch.
Mm.
Now, if there was a catch, the only catch I could think of was actually getting your body into Morecambe looking at the festival.
Mm-hmm.
So, I came away and obviously wrote about it and I thought about it. And I thought, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go back next year, because this Festival of Light and Water was supposed to be going on the following year, which was 2005.
Mm-hmm.
So I marked my calendar and I thought, I'll go back and have a look at Morecambe in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
To see what's going on, just have a little nosy around, see,
sure.
If I'm delusional or a madman, I'll go and check on what I thought and felt, and I'll go and check it out.
Sure.
So, as 2005 came round, I checked with the local the local council, the hoteliers, and yes, there was going to be a festival of Light and Water, Water and Light.
Yeah.
So as the time approached to August, I found out that it had been cancelled.
Hmm.
They'd actually pulled the plug on it.
Hmm.
Apparently, this festival had been going on for donkey's years, for 20 years at least.
Yeah.
So I believe. So I was very shocked to find out that they cancelled it, because there was... So I checked with the council, and they told me that it had been cancelled because of economic reasons.
Hmm.
Well, as I previously told you, the town was absolutely jam full. There wasn't an hotel. I was very lucky to get a bed, you know. So I didn't believe that for 1 minute. I didn't believe that they'd cancelled it for economic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because the bars were full, the restaurants were full, the big old cafes. Everybody was there spending money. So obviously, the festival was a very big success for the town.
Yeah.
And then I found out that all of a sudden, there was having a festival of light, out of the blue, down the course, further 10, 15 miles down the course, there's a place called Blackpool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Blackpool's famous in England, is the biggest seaside resort.
Yeah, yeah.
It is a very famous seaside resort.
Yep.
And it was the very first town to arrange for illuminations, what we call in England the illuminations.
Mm.
We call them the lights.
Mm.
It was the first seaside resort ever to be named or have an illumination ceremony every winter.
Mm.
And that had been going on since the electric light bulb was invented, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think it was 100 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very surprised to find that Morecambe had lost its regular festival of light and water, yet Blackpool, even though it was millions of people go to Blackpool, are suddenly announcing that they've got one.
Sure.
It's the same council. The same council that run Blackpool run Morecambe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the same officials in power for the local area control who has the festivals and when. So I find it very, very strange that they cancel this festival of light in Morecambe, especially when I say it wasn't for economic reasons. It was full.
Hmm.
So, I decided, instead of going to the Morecambe one, I'll go and have a look at the Blackpool one.
Yeah.
It was in October 2005. So I toddled off to Blackpool to have a look at that one, to see if I was, just to put my own mind at rest, because all these thoughts were coming to me the previous year about the Ferris wheel and the music and the crowd. And I thought, all right, then I'll go and have a look at Blackpool and see what's going on there.
Mm.
So I drags my wife off to Blackpool, and she doesn't know. I'm checking, I'm not telling her all these things that I'm looking at. I'm just saying I want to research what's going on. So
sure.
We end up in Blackpool, and I was astonished. I was astonished because so many modern art monuments had appeared on the seafront, which are very nice in a way. They look nice. They were very presentable.
Mm-hmm.
But it was wasn't the sort of thing you'd expect in a working class seaside resort. It's a working class resort. It's Blackpool. It's an end party, stag party sort of place these days. It's not what you'd call a place for the lovers of art. It's eat chips, drink beer, enjoy yourself, get drunk sort of place now. So I'm looking at these monuments during the day and I'm thinking, there's something not right with this. I'm going to have to check on it. And yeah. I started looking into what were actually going on. Who was opening the actual illuminations, the people behind it, and the artists that were getting in to open it. And there was some similar symbolism involved with the music and the festival itself. There was parties, pop groups playing, and somewhat similar to what was happening in Morecambe. And I started to look at what the actual mechanics of the resort was.
Yeah.
And what it basically is in Blackpool, you do like a procession. You proceed down the promenade, and you look at the illuminations that's on shore, and literally millions of people pass through the illuminations every year. It's a constant stream of people in cars and on foot that actually parade themselves through the illuminations. And so I thought, well, I'll go and have a look on foot. I'll go and walk and take in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And the first thing I noticed, and the pictures are on my blogger, and David Icke has got it on his site.
Yeah.
In an article, a PDF they can download. And the first thing that struck me was the massive Ferris wheel that's been placed on a pier in Blackpool. And the way it was lit up, exactly to the inch, the same as Morecambe was a year previously. The lighting on the Ferris wheel, it literally flashed me in the face. And the first thing I saw was the mechanics of the Ferris wheel, the pyramid sort of axle that it's on.
Yeah.
Was definitely lit up like a pyramid, and the actual Ferris wheel itself was lit up like the sun. And I'd been researching into it anyway, and I realised straight away that this was ancient Egyptian symbolism for the mound of earth rising out. It was called the Benben.
Yeah.
Benben stone.
Yeah.
It's on top of an obelisk. When the earth, according to the ancient Egyptians, the reptilians created the sun, and it came. When it was created, it popped up out of the watery chaos.
Yeah.
And took the shape of a pyramid. That's where we get the shape of the actual pyramid. And they called the Benben. Then they said it was the sun.
Yeah.
So what we had on the seaside resort, lit up in the Ferris wheel, was blatant. As far as I'm concerned, blatant ancient Egyptian symbolism.
It's a reconstruction of the myth of the Benben stone, right?
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. And it really was smacking me in the face. I could not believe. And then I started to look around again, and I thought, hang on a minute, there's something not right with, you know, there's something different about this festival. I felt like I was taking part in something that I shouldn't have been taking part in. But, you know, the people were just streaming through these illuminated monuments and whatever you want to call them, lights lit up, and there was just treating it as though, yes, I've come to see these illuminations. They weren't thinking, well, why am I doing it?
Yeah.
Why am I here doing this?
Sure.
You know, I wouldn't say the actual illuminations were so exciting that you had to go and see them. they were just basic figures and pictures for little kiddies to see.
Hmm.
But they wasn't, in this day and age, there wasn't anything exciting about them.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to realise then that there was something strange about it. So I checked up on the ancient Egyptian festivals, what they used to have.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, obviously, I don't want to bore you listeners to death trying to do history, because it's not my thing, but basically, in the ancient Egyptian times,
mm-hmm.
you used to have a festival where the sun, the pharaoh, the sun king, or whatever it was at the time, travelled, did a procession ritual between temples.
Yeah.
And what happened was they pretended, well, they didn't pretend, they sent, the king did a procession past all the people. And as this king or pharaoh was passing from temple to temple,
mm.
people on the side were offering him food and drink all the way down.
Mm.
Something to symbolise his riches or whatever.
Sure.
And what I realised in Blackpool is the authorities lead you in a similar sort of procession.
Mm.
And as you're going down the procession, whether you're in a car or whether you're on foot, you're passing burger stalls, restaurants, bars, and people selling trinkets and bits of toys for the kids and stuff like that.
Sure.
And I realised then that what we were literally doing is we were actually carrying out a procession ritual.
Yeah.
You know, and what we were doing, we were seeing what the public were seen to be doing was paying respect to the illuminations.
Mm.
And that's how it felt to me. We were actually giving respect out. We were actually respecting and showing respect to the illuminated monuments and symbolism that was around us. It couldn't have been anything else. And as I say, the major feature was the massive Ferris wheel showing the pyramid and the sun symbolism rising out of it. It was over the water.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so it was actually rising out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly the same as the Egyptians, ancient Egyptians, believed.
Mm.
And when I took everything in, it seemed to me like the authorities, the actual council, I don't know what you call it in Sweden and what you have, but we call it a council here, and they organise all the local events and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I realised then that the council had actually organised, whether they knew it or not, an ancient festival.
Sure.
Because it was exactly the same as it happened in ancient Egypt. So, and I thought, well, why have they arranged it like this? Why is nobody clicking on that we're being forced into a festival that's not what they're saying it is?
Mm.
According to the local council, it's just a thing to attract to the seaside.
Sure, sure.
To get you to spend your money.
Yeah.
But there was more, a lot more to it than that. You could actually feel the energy. You could actually feel that there was something more to it.
Matthew, I'm looking at some of the pictures of you know, the new promenade at Blackpool. You have some pictures from above, basically, that shows the entire prom, I guess.
Yeah, yes, I know what you mean.
Yeah, and these, because I don't know if the let's see here, I'm backing up here on the page. There is the Morecambe monuments are. Is this the same place as the stone jetty? Is this the same place, or is that at Morecambe?
That is the actual stone jetty is at Morecambe, but it's very similar images that you can see from above in Blackpool.
Yeah, yeah, okay, okay.
It's very similar.
Okay.
You can only see the circle shapes and stuff like that from above.
Sure, because one thing that really, you know, caught my eye here was that the new at Blackpool, the prom there, actually ends up or goes to a path, and the place there is actually called Star Gate, right?
Well, yeah, you're right. Well, that's what I mean about a procession.
Mm, yeah.
They're going from a place, the procession goes from a place called Jin Inn.
Mm. Interesting.
Which I link to not the gin you drink, but an ancient gin was a genie.
Yeah, the Arabian type. Yeah.
Exactly.
Deity.
Yes, and what they've done, they've built a tree that has no leaves on. It's just they call it the magic tree, but there's nothing on it. It's just a bare tree with no leaves on.
Yeah, yeah.
And the procession goes from that tree to a place called Stargate.
Yeah.
But at Stargate, it's called the end of the line, Stargate, the end where the trams stop.
Yeah.
There is absolutely nothing there. It's just a sign saying Stargate. you know, and...
Very interesting.
There's some sort of procession ritual going on.
Yeah.
And it's linked with a tree and a Stargate.
But where, during when they had the concert, on what end of this prom did they have the scene and so forth?
At Blackpool, it's big. It's a really big place.
Okay, yeah.
So there was actual singing on stages all in several different places.
Ah, okay, I see.
But
yeah.
It's known as the Golden Mile. It's called the Golden Mile.
Mm-hmm.
The actual procession is called Walking the Golden Mile.
Hmm, interesting.
Obviously, Golden is linked to the old pharaohs anyway.
Sure, yeah.
But at Morecambe, there was only one stage, and that was next to the actual Ferris wheel, showing the ancient Egyptian symbolism.
Yeah.
And I was started on this path of checking out pop stars and music and people's energies. Obviously then, during this time, Live 8 was going on.
Yeah.
So that led me to have a look at that. Because Live 8, obviously with hindsight now, it's nearly two years ago now, it's 2007.
Mm-hmm.
In the 2 years since Live 8 took place, after checking the official Live 8 website and looking at news reports,
yeah.
It's been, as far as helping people in Africa is concerned, it's been a waste of time.
Mm.
They've done nothing, basically. Even the own, even the Live 8 official website, and anybody can tune into it, is admitting that this thing's not right and it's in collapse.
Hmm.
When you think about it, Live 8 was a free festival.
Mm, yeah.
You didn't have to pay. Obviously, there were black market tickets going on in some places.
Mm.
But basically, again, it was a free festival.
Hmm.
Now, according to, when I started researching Live 8, the first thing I noticed was that Bob Geldof announced he was going to do Live 8 on the 31st of May, 2005.
Mm-hmm.
And, that gave him five or six weeks, to organise the biggest pop festival in the world in several different countries.
Mm, yeah.
Now, basically, going off what the them facts, Bob Geldof announcing that on the news, it's basically, to be blunt, I don't want to sound abusive to your readers, it's bullshit. There's no way on earth could one person organise worldwide concerts in 5 weeks.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Sure.
I have trouble sorting the laundry out in 5 weeks, so I'm organising. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
And this is a man that's supposed to be a rebel,
yeah.
And a fighter for the poor.
Sure.
But it struck me that he was asking a hell of a lot in to get that done in 5 weeks.
Mm, yeah.
But lo and behold, 5 week time, his concert's going on all over the world.
Yeah.
Not one snag. he announced he was having a party under the Eiffel Tower. He was having a party on the Brandenburg Gate. He was naming all these symbolic places. And I thought to myself, hang on a minute, you're not going to let him have a party under the Eiffel Tower. You're not going to let him have a party at Brandenburg Gate in Berlin.
Yeah.
You know, and they didn't, but they made him have one as close as they could to the symbolic places they announced. And I started straight away investigating like that as soon as it was announced, and I was listening to Bob's every word.
Sure.
And I started looking at the places what he was announcing, and there was one in Rome called Circus Maximus, where they held one of these Live Aid concerts. And if you check into Circus Maximus, it was the place of where it's not there now, the obelisk has been moved, but there was an obelisk at Circus Maximus that came from Karnak Temple in Egypt.
Interesting.
Luxor, Thebes, in Egypt.
Right.
And that was a symbolic some place where entertainment had gone on. And people had been killed. And then I looked at a couple of the other places. Obviously, I'm not going to mention them all because it'd take me all night. But then he had I'm not very good on French, but Palace de Versailles. Versailles. Palace de Versailles in Paris, because he couldn't have it at the Eiffel Tower, but even though he announced he was going to have it at the Eiffel Tower. But if you check into the concert they had in Paris at this Palace de Versailles, you will find that it was the Louis XIV, Louis XV, Louis XVI, their palace. And they were known as the Sun Kings.
Oh, yeah.
So then you start thinking, you think, hang on, isn't it too coincidental now? Everything seems to be related to the sun.
Yeah, sure. An Egyptian symbolism.
Exactly, or the Illuminati.
Indeed.
Obviously, a lot of your listeners know all about the Illuminati. I don't mention them.
Sure.
But, and then I thought of Hyde Park, and then I thought, well, what's going on in Hyde Park? And then you find out that they're having the concert in Hyde Park, but that's where the Serpentine Lakes are. Serpent is linked to Hyde Park, and so is Princess Diana, because they've done a serpent-type monument to her in Hyde Park. You know, and then I thought, well, hang on a minute, they seem to be... And then I looked at... I thought, well, I'm going further away, and I started to look at America, having a little... arrange a little party over there at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Now, I've been writing about the Philadelphia Museum of Art in my new book, and basically... I've been studying about the Rocky movies. That's a different story. Anyway, the Museum of Art in Philadelphia. If you start looking into it and really get into it and spend some time on it, you will find that it basically it's an ancient temple. It's built as a replica of an ancient Roman temple, and it's absolutely covered in griffins. The roof of the museum in Philadelphia is full of griffins, symbolic flying dragons, lizards, whatever you want to call them.
Sure.
They call them griffins.
Sure.
And it's linked to the Freemasons, Franklin, one of the founders of America.
Sure, I mean.
And you start thinking, hang on a minute, they're attracting these people, everywhere they're going, it seems to have some connection. It can't be a coincidence, it's just too many of them.
Yeah, sure.
To the sun or the serpent or the Illuminati. And and you start thinking, hang on a minute, all these people, all these nice places that they treasure, I mean, they don't want thousands of people trampling all over Buckingham Palace Gardens. But I'm sure if they wanted to have a concert there, Bob Geldof would have been able to arrange it. When I started thinking and going more deep into it, I started to believe, actually believe, that they were attracting, they were do anything for charity. These people don't give a hell about people suffering. Bob Geldof's not going to worry about, even though he comes on TV shouting this one's feeding and that one's feeding.
Mm.
He's a millionaire.
Mm.
He cannot connect with poor people, people starving.
Mm.
And neither can the people that sat in government that's actually arranged all this.
Sure.
And I started thinking, it's not, they want to attract as many people as they can and as much attention as they can to these areas.
And why
is there must be a reason for it. They're not doing it for nothing. There must be a reason for it.
Sure.
The first thing I put out in my mind is we're doing it for any good, because I don't think that it's possible that they can do any good by attracting people to parties.
Mm-hmm.
The people that actually go to the parties is going to enjoy it.
Sure.
Somebody sat in Africa starving to death not going to worry whether Paul McCartney's going to turn up to sing Hey Jude.
Yeah, sure.
It's not going to happen. And that's when I started to really concentrate on what was going on. Why was all these people being attracted to certain symbolic places?
Yeah.
And then it just came to me, basically, it's they want to create energy, what we call an atmosphere.
Yeah.
I call it spiritual energy.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, for some reason, they want thousands of bodies in these symbolic locations, and they want them to enjoy themselves.
Mm.
It's nothing to do with wanting them to enjoy themselves. To enjoy themselves,
sure.
There must have been a purpose. And the conclusion I came to is that somehow they can extract energy out of the bodies of human beings, and so, and because it's in a special location, it somehow feeds the symbolism at these locations, or whoever created the symbolism at these locations, like a sort of knock-on effect, get the people to turn up,
sure.
Get them to enjoy themselves, get them to let off steam, let them to get off energy, and then we will collect that energy. I went down that sort of path, because that was the only way I could go. There was obviously a reason going on.
Sure.
And then I started from there, from the Live 8, I started to go further afield, and I started to look into, because what was going on around me at the time was the major film, I'm forgetting his name now, I'm in mind gone dead.
Tell us something more about it, maybe it will come to you.
Realised that a major film had been made, I'd been a visitor at Roslyn Chapel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you mean the Da Vinci Code?
Thank you.
Okay.
No, really, just went there.
Yeah, sure.
Da Vinci Code.
Yeah.
Da Vinci Code was going on as well in 2005.
Sure.
And I've been a visitor at Roslyn Chapel since 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been going up there. Once every 6 months, I was very attracted to Roslyn Chapel. I haven't wrote about Roslyn Chapel yet, but I've been researching it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept going up, and then all of a sudden, the Da Vinci Code is on the scene.
Yeah.
And it's full of people. I've been going to Roslyn Chapel Sunday mornings, driving up from where I live. It's quite a couple of hours' drive.
Mm-hmm.
And there'd only be me there. They used to have a service on Sunday morning, and I'd be there Sunday afternoon, and there'd be about two or three people in, all Sunday afternoon. Once the Da Vinci Code's been out, and been in the cinemas, and the book's been read, there was coaches filling up.
Indeed.
People piling off coaches. It's only a small building.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there were coachfuls of people going in.
Sure.
And they're cramming themselves in this little place, and
yeah.
I'm thinking, what the bloody hell's going on here? And it was absolutely crammed with people all going, oh, the Da Vinci Code's been here, and they don't have to look at these tickets and all this. And they weren't interested in the history or anything. They just wanted to
be there.
Be there because they'd read it in the Da Vinci Code book. indeed. On the movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I started thinking, hang on a minute, these people are being attracted to symbolic places.
Yeah, indeed.
Through the movie industry.
Yeah.
They have created hundreds of people going to a chapel every day where there weren't anybody else. You used to get visitors, but yeah. Nowhere near what there is now.
Yeah.
So I started thinking, hang on a minute, because Rodwin Chapel is a very, very weird place. It's a very atmospheric place, and I don't think there's anything good about Roslyn Chapel. I think it's a very negative place.
Okay.
But all these people are going there and letting off emotional energy.
Indeed, yeah.
So they're excited because they've gone to this place.
Yeah.
And I started to link that together with the Live 8 and the things at Blackpool and the things at Morecambe and things I were taking into my mind over several months.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I started to check into festivals, other festivals.
Yeah.
And I started looking around the country and I started noticing that major pop festivals, as we're getting on to Glastonbury, we're going towards Glastonbury.
Indeed,
I started noticing that certain festivals in this country are also in symbolic places. Now, in England, the most famous one, Eric, is Glastonbury.
Yeah,
it's the most famous one. It's sprouted around everywhere, all over the world. Everybody knows about Glastonbury.
Indeed, very big, yeah.
So I started researching into that. And I found some real stuff out. It goes back to the 70s. Sadly, I'm old enough to remember the 70s, and I knew exactly what they were talking about when they mentioned the groups that helped form it.
Yeah, yeah.
I've gone into symbolism behind the actual pop groups and stuff that first formed there back in 1971. But obviously, it took me hours to go into all that. Basically, I started to realise that similar to being attracted to Live 8, similar to being attracted to Roslyn Chapel in the Da Vinci Code, because of the Da Vinci Code,
yeah.
And me being attracted to Blackpool Illuminations and festivals in Morecambe because of pop singers, I started to... It all came to me at once. I started to realise that I'm being enticed to these places, and other people are being enticed to these places for pleasure. We're being enticed. Come to this festival. Come to this symbolic building.
Yeah.
Let's all go and have a party at Live 8. Let's all run across the Circus Maximus and dance around in a sun palace.
Sure.
In Paris. And I started to put everything together, and I started to realise that somebody somewhere, some force somewhere, is actually gaining from the attraction.
Mm.
Whoever's attracting us to these places, even though we all want to enjoy ourselves, I'm not saying that, some force behind it is attracting people to these places.
Yeah.
So I started looking into Glastonbury really, really deeply, and... I realised then that these modern-day festivals today have been in plan. They've been planned for decades.
Mm-hmm, mm.
And they're growing bigger and bigger and bigger every year. From Glastonbury in 1971, a few hundred people, there is now 150,000 people. That go to Glastonbury Festival.
Yeah, it's huge, yeah.
It's 150,000 people in a few fields, a couple of fields in a certain area that's linked to ley lines, sun power lines, to Stonehenge.
Yeah.
That sort of thing, in that sort of area in the country. And I started to realise that... Somebody's gaining a hell of a lot out of this.
Indeed.
It's not financial. It's more of a spiritual energy.
Yeah, yeah.
So as I say, I looked into the history, and what they'd done at Glastonbury, to cut a hell of a long story short, is the first thing they did was build a pyramid stage.
They
actually built a pyramid in a cow field for the performers to perform on.
Sure.
So I checked into the history of who were responsible for building the pyramid stage, as it's known now. It's famous. It's a famous stage in England. I'm sure the music fans in Sweden and anywhere else will know about Glastonbury's pyramid stage. So I checked into the, I went back into the 70s and I checked on who'd actually been behind creating this pyramid stage. And it turns out that it's people, well, the bloodline of the Churchill family. Winston Churchill's daughter, Arabella, and I'm forgetting the bloke, the man's name that helped her was Randolph Churchill's, which is the son of Winston, his private secretary. And these people, behind the scenes, well, not exactly behind the scenes, they don't deny it, actually planned to have pyramid stages and call it the Glastonbury Festival. So what I found out then is, well, there's nothing different to that than actually a bloodline like the Churchill family. Who I believe is linked to the Illuminati, anyway. Or the people that actually built Circus Maximus. That was built by the ancient Illuminati. Or the Palace Visalis. It's built, the foundations of such things are all linked by bloodline. Illuminati, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
So then I realised then, I thought, well, hang on a minute. There's no difference now in 2005 when Live 8 was going on, than there was in, say, 100 BC. Because what you've got a certain bloodline that's basically laying the foundation stones for entertainment venues. What you've got in Glastonbury, obviously you've got the Churchill family, but Circus Maximus and Palace de Versailles, that was done by King Philip the 16th or 15th or something like that. What I'm saying is they arrange for the venue. They lay the symbolic foundation and the financial backing to start it off. So I see that as they're claiming it's their area, their territory. If you're going to come to enjoy yourself in a certain place, what they're saying is if you want to come and enjoy yourself and celebrate, you're doing it because we are letting you do it, and you're doing it where we're telling you to do it.
Matthew, I do want to continue now in the next segment, because we're running out of time in this one, but I do want to kind of get into more, I guess, also the mechanics potentially, you know, behind this and what the drives might be, and even, you know, potentially what the energy might be used for, the intent and all of this. And I have a bunch of points and questions that I want to get to. I'm also going to ask you about the upcoming concert called Live Earth that connects very much with Live 8, of course. And this is going to be on 777 this year. So there's lots more to get to, Matthew, that I would love to talk more with you about. But before we kind of go there, why won't you end things off here for this segment, telling people about your blog, exactly how they can find that, and also tell us when your new book will be out.
I'm sorry I've ranted on a bit.
No.
My blog, in the next couple of weeks, I will have a new book out called Is It Me for a Moment? Breaking the Serpent's Spell. It's about breaking out of the hypnosis that I believe you're under by forces on this world.
Yeah.
But, and You can find it will be available on David Icke Books. Simple as that. But I will be advertising it on the blogger as soon as it's available.
Yeah.
And that's it really.
And the blog, I can just mention the blog address again is matthew-deluze.blogspot.com, and Deluze is spelled D-E-L-O-O-Z-E. So that's matthew-deluze.blogspot.com. Do check that out. Matthew has a bunch of interesting articles up there for you to read. He's got a new book coming out, and there's lots more coming. So again, Matthew, I want to thank you so much for this segment, and we're going to continue in the next one, okay?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Thank you.
This is Red Eyes Radio.
We will continue talking with Matthew Deluze now in our subscriber section. If you are new to the program or if you're a regular listener, please know that our subscriber section is what keeps us going and having the regular show coming to you for free twice a week. Around 5% of all you who download and listen to the Red Eyes Creations radio show are subscribers at this point. And to keep things going like we do now, we do need your help. So I hope you do consider subscribing and help us bump up the number of subscribers to our site. At this point, it's you who decide if we are to continue the way we are doing now. As you know, we don't carry any advertisement either in the radio show or on the website, and we want to keep it that way. So all you guys who already are subscribers, thank you so much for your help and support. We couldn't have made it this far without you guys. So again, thank you so much. And we hate to regurgitate this at the end of each show, but at this point, this is the reality of the matter. Thank you for listening to the program. We will be back with Michael Tesarion next Thursday. Remember to drop by our radio section and read up on how you can participate in the show. Also, thanks to Fredrik Palmgren for the production of the radio program. This is Henrik Palmgren. Until next Thursday, we'll see you on the web.
Welcome.
This is our most desperate hour. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.